Good evening and welcome to the first presentation in this our 14th season of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with help from our webmaster, here taking pictures, Haiwong Wan, and our research instruction coordinator at the back, Brian Carson. Ryan Dowell and Patrick Peters designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Shadon Melke. Our speaker tonight grew up on a farm near Glendale, Kentucky, where he discovered his love of books, many delivered by the Bookmobile from the Hardin County Library. His family later moved to Elizabethtown, where he discovered his love for music, which he pursued at Moorhead State University, receiving his BA in music education, followed by a master's in choral conducting at Southern Seminary in Louisville. His interest in tea began when he spent a summer teaching in the Middle East. He and his wife Shelley, who's also a musician, traveled frequently to Great Britain, where they picked up the ritual of tea and infused it into their daily routine in their Danville, Kentucky home. In 1990, the Richardsons purchased and restored the 1842 Elmwood Inn, located in the Civil War village of Perryville, Kentucky. And Shelley began serving an English-style afternoon tea that began to draw international attention. This hobby eventually became the couple's vocation as Bruce began his career as a tea importer and blender for the family's new wholesale business, Elmwood Inn Fine Teas. They closed the tea room in 2004 and moved their production facility to Danville, Kentucky. Bruce and Shelley wrote their first book in 1984. Since then, Bruce has written 14 books on tea, a passion which has taken him around the world to India, Sri Lanka, England, France, and Japan, where he will be giving lectures later this year. In 2011, Bruce was named Tea Master for the Boston Tea Party Ships and Museum, and is a contributing editor for Tea Time, Fresh Cup, and Tea Journey magazines. He's a frequent lecturer at tea events around the world. When not writing or traveling, Bruce enjoys cooking and reading, and their Perryville home is filled with more than 3,000 books, the legacy of a bookmobile that stopped for a young farm boy in Hardin County, Kentucky, 60 years ago. The theme of Bruce's talk tonight, The Tea Things of Jane Austen, is one of his most popular and was recently presented at the convention of the Jane Austen Society of North Americanists in Minneapolis. Please give a warm welcome to Bruce Richardson. Bruce.
Okay. Good evening, and thank you for letting me come to Bowling Green. And I have a soft spot in my heart for anything that has to do with libraries, because, as you know, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for libraries. That was, as a small farm boy, the books that came into my life were my salvation. They gave me entree to a world that I would never have known. And I believe you probably have that same passion in your hearts as well. Also, I'm delighted that you are what we call teaist, I hope, because you not only have discovered books and reading, but you also have discovered tea, the ritual of tea, what it can mean in your life, hopefully. If you haven't, maybe we can convert a few more good souls tonight. I was just telling a story. I was in Japan back in January to produce this cover story for a magazine, where I shot this photograph of Mount Fuji and all the tea gardens around there. But I had the opportunity to go up to meet with a farmer who has grown the award-winning teas three times for the entire world with 800 entries in the past 5 years. And at 4,000 feet, I went into his 400-year-old home after he introduced me to his tea bushes that his grandfather had set out 100 years ago. His house was 400 years old. I looked up at these beautiful hand-hewn beams all perfectly placed together there with the folding screens that still had the paper in them. And we sat on tatami mats, and he made me tea. And when I tell this story, people say, well, did he speak English? And I say, no. Did you speak Japanese? And I say, no. And they say, well, how did you communicate with this man? I said, we were people of tea. You see, those of us who have, as the Chinese would say, oh, this man has tea in him. Or if they might make an aside about somebody who's maybe a little naughty, they say, well, he has too much tea in him. So we were men of tea, and he made tea for me. He put that cup of tea into my hand that he had made, and I sniffed it, bowed to him. He understood what I was smelling. He knew what was going on in my eager mouth. And as I took that first sip, he waited, and I went, that's all it took. You see, we were talking the language that teaists have been speaking now for over 1,000 years. And as Okakura Kakuzo would say in the classic Book of Tea, we are talking about the cup of humanity. So no matter if I go into Cornwall and have tea with a British housewife, or if I go to Japan, to the top of a mountain, or if I go into Argentina and have tea there, or go to India, or to the top of the mountain at Darjeeling, wherever I go, someone puts a cup of tea in my hand, we are immediately speaking to each other, and Okakura would say, ah, it's the cup of humanity that brings you together. So, how do we turn that into talking about Jane Austen? You'll see. So let's see. Let's see what we can do with our good friend Jane. So, you know, if you're not a teaist, you may be a Janeite. So let's just hope we have some Janeites in the audience tonight. Well, there's the main thing you're going to take away tonight has to do with this common phrase that we've known since children. And I'm going to see if you can finish this phrase for me. Are you ready? All the tea in
China.
Now you know where all the tea came from that went into Boston Harbor in 1773. You know now the origin of all the tea that went into the teapots of Jane Austen in Bath or any place in London. Wherever she had tea, it all came again from China. Why? We're going to see why. Let's look at tea from China. It was the only place, really, that we were importing tea. The West was importing tea only from China in the 1700s and the 1600s and the 1700s. Let's look a little bit at that. We knew, because China was a closed society to the West, you know, no one could go into the country except maybe at the port of Canton. And so you would have to stay there, and that's where they dealt with all of the Westerners. So we knew nothing about how tea was made. It was a big mystery to us. So here we have one of the earliest paintings of what the English thought tea making looked like. Now, they got it pretty right, because those are baskets that we still use sometimes in small farming today. They actually dry the leaf after it's been rolled, because there's charcoal at the bottom, and then just gently roast the leaf. Now, a couple years ago, I got a call from MTV. I said, why is MTV calling me? They said, well, we're doing a story on tea that for a manly teas, and we've come across this story that there is tea that's picked by monkeys. And I thought, oh no, I've heard this so many times. So they said, is that true? And I said, I'm sorry, it's not true. But it sold a lot of tea over the years. Because you understand, if somebody tells you, well, that, you know, monkeys picked this tea, or the Buddhist monks would throw rocks at the monkeys at the top of those camellia trees, and the monkeys would then pick the leaves and throw them back to the Buddhist monks, and the Buddhist monks would take those leaves and roll them up and make tea out of them. That makes a great story. And as a tea supplier, I understand a story like that can raise the price of that tea about four times. So when you go into a tea store and someone says, would you like our best monkey-picked tea? You have to understand, well, monkeys didn't actually pick that tea, but in today's society, those of us who produce tea save the word monkey or monkey picked to put on the name to say that that is our finest tea. It's the very, very best. Lord knows monkeys don't pick that tea. And as I told that reporter, by the way, you wouldn't want to drink that tea because you don't know where those monkeys' hands have been. So this journey for tea was quite an adventure. You see, the tea was picked usually in early spring, usually before April the 24th, and the tea was picked up in the mountains, and then it would be processed right there, and would be put on the backs of workers who would bring it down to and a long journey, camping along the way, maybe 3, 4, 5 weeks to get to a navigable stream where they would put it on a small flatboat. That flatboat eventually might get down to the Pearl River, where it would be put on maybe a junk. And that Pearl River junk would eventually get down to the port of Canton, where all the tea that had been picked in early spring would be kept in warehouses, and it would be put into large wooden chests and packed in by men getting in there and packing it down with their feet. I promise you, Jane Austen never drank any tea that hadn't already been pressed down by some man's feet. So that tea would be collected. Now it's already 8 months old, and out in the harbor come these huge ships ready to pick up this tea and take it first, not to London. The first tea came back was imported by the Dutch, so it was going to the Netherlands. So here you see huge ships out there from the Dutch East India Company, built especially to hold cargoes of tea. And what a great price they commanded for that tea by the time it got back to Europe. But listen, that tea that had been picked by April left the port in late December, early January, took 9 to 12 months to get back to Europe. So by the time it got to the consumer, it was close to 2 years old. Not the best tea in the world, by the way. Tea was first introduced both in Great Britain and in the colonies through the Starbucks of the time, the coffee houses, right? So here we have the very first advertisement for tea in a London coffee house. And I want you to remember this date, because we're going to refer to it when we see another date pretty soon. This coffee house tea was introduced in 1658. You know, Shakespeare never drank tea. He was already dead. Can you imagine what a writer he might have been if he had just had a little setting of tea? The words he could have gotten out of people, you know. Talk about tea and scandal. That's it right there. So that date is 1658 for the British. Let's come to the colonies. 11 years earlier, 1647. The Dutch East India Company's director, Peter Stuyvesant, was brought in to be the new governor of the Dutch colony called, as you know, New Amsterdam, which is now what?
New York.
Yeah, New York, New York. And Peter Stuyvesant, in his journal, we have an inventory of everything he brought with him. Guess what he brought? Teapots, tea things, tea cups. We know he's not going to bring all that unless he has what? He has tea, right? He's a pretty smart man, and he works for the company that's bringing tea in. You know he had tea with him. So the next time you see one of your British friends, you say, oh, by the way, did you know that we were drinking tea here in America 11 years before it was even advertised in your Starbucks back in London? Yeah. Well, who was the very first British tea drinker at Hampton Court? Again, it was not an English person. It was the Portuguese bride of Charles II. You know, the British often had to go out of town to find somebody to marry them. And Charles went to Portugal to find his bride, who came over when she was about 17. And he met her in Winchester. That's where she landed, and that's where he first met her. And Janeites, why also do we know Winchester? It's because she's buried in the cathedral there. That's right. So with her, her dowry was tea that she brought over, because the Portuguese had been drinking tea for quite a while. Now, the English East India Company wanted to give the new queen a gift of tea. They heard she was a tea drinker. They had none. They had to go to their Dutch friends to get tea to give to the Portuguese queen at Hampton Court. Here you have a 1727 picture, and this was the typical portrait of somebody who had had money in England at the time. Now you see here that this is a family who's having their family portrait done, and what do they bring out? They bring in all their tea things. So they bring out all their best tea things. Why do they do this? To show that they've got money, they know what's going on in the world, they're worldly folks. So yes, so they always brought out their tea things. Let's pay attention to the mother here and how she's holding her teacup. Number one, what do you notice about the teacup? It has no what? And that's right. You know, teacups first did not have handles. You know, this is a teacup from about that era, and here we have the mother showing you how to hold that teacup. What do you notice about her little pinky? It's just a little bit. And why? Because if you naturally pick up this teacup, your little fingers coming out to the side just to give it a little bit of counterweight, a little balance. So that is balance. Ladies and gentlemen, this is pretentiousness. So the manager of the Ritz in London tells me, "Mr. Richardson, I know when there's an American in the IT room because I look out there and all these men are trying to stick their pinkies out because they're there with their wives and their wife has said, 'You're going to go to tea with me at the Ritz and you're going to stick your pinky out.' And they think that's what it's all about." That's right. You know, Duncan Hines said a lot of men have missed a lot of good eating because of their fear of tea rooms. Well, that probably is one of the justifications for that. That little thing right there. All right. Now, when I say the name East India Company, it should be boo, hiss, just this is the meanest, most despicable, corrupt corporation that was ever on the face of the earth. And there's no argument about that. So it received a charter in 1600 by Elizabeth I, which pretty much said, look, you can go on the other side of Africa. What's over there, you can exploit. You can set up a government. You can coin money. You can make up your own governments, and you can just make all the money you can. If anything you can bring back and sell it, fine. Just give us a little dividend from that. You see? And so this corporation had carte blanche to go any place on the other side of Africa. Now today, when we know when somebody says, what's on the other side of Africa, we're pretty well educated to know that, well, we know there's India. We know that China is here. Above it is Russia. Down here, you know, Japan, Korea's right above it. Down here, it's the Philippines. We know where all those places are. Back then, people had no idea. You know, here be dragons is what they would think. It was just, that's why they often would call, they would get all these countries mixed up, and they would see somebody from China and say, well, they're Japanese. Or they would sometimes lump them all together and say, well, they're all Indians. So it took a long time for us to really discern that there were individual countries there with individual cultures, individual people living there. And it took us a while, and sometimes I think we still have a hard time getting that right. But let's all try to do that. So here you have the East India Company. They could not even park all their ships in the Thames. There's just too many of them. They couldn't build enough warehouses in London. So what did they have to do? They went out to the outskirts of town and built the Docklands. And here we have the Docklands. And you see all the docks that were built just to bring in all the ships from the East India Company to unload and put in the warehouses. Now that's the place to live these days is the Docklands. You know, it's all coming back to life. All the tea then had to go through the official auction in London. That auction started in 1679. It ended in 1998. Quite a long heritage. My writing friend in London, Jane Pettigrew, was at that last auction. And can you imagine, there was a great competition to buy the last chest of tea that came through that historic auction. And so this chest of tea that had come in from Sri Lanka was the last chest to go through. And all the bidders were bidding against it, and it got down to two of the big British companies that were going against each other. You know, they wanted to have that last one. And finally, that chest of tea went for £42,000. Still, only $2.17 a cup once you make it, so still cheaper than a Kentucky bourbon, so it's okay. But you know what? That auction closed in 1998. London, because London was no longer the center of the tea world. Where is the center of all the commercial teas today? It's moved to Hamburg, Germany. That's where all of the big players are there. Why? Because Hamburg is a big port city where huge container ships come in. And so that's where all the major tea brokers are today, in Hamburg. And by the way, the Germans drink some of the best and most expensive teas in the world. So let's look at going back to in history. What teas were being drunk? These were the common teas from 1650 until about 1835. The East India Company lost their monopoly in 1834. So let's look at this very precise time period. Here are the major teas. The first one, we would call it Boohea, B-O-H-E-A. This is a Staffordshire teapot with Boohea tea emblazoned on it. And often, if someone would just, when once you'd come over for tea, they would say, would you come over for a cup of Boohea? It was just the common name for tea. It was also the cheapest tea as well. But we think Boohea came from the Wuyi Mountains. The Wuyi Mountains are one of the most prolific tea-growing areas. And, you know, the Western traders on that year-long voyage from Canton back to England, you know, the word Wuyi somehow became Boohea, you see. It's a long way. A lot of rum went through their mouth, and it just got a different sound by the time it got back to Europe. Boohea was the most inexpensive black tea. Kangu was a much better grade. It means disciplined, very well made. Kung Fu, it comes also from that idea. Souchong, this was another large leaf tea. All three of these were black teas. Now, guess what? We were drinking green teas. So here are the two green teas that were common of the day. One was Haisan, and the other was Singlo from the Sunglo Mountains. So those are your five teas. All five of these teas were tossed overboard in Boston in 1773. And by the way, they were the same teas that Jane Austen was drinking later. She died in 1817. 2 years ago, I had an opportunity to go to Kew Palace, and they let me photograph the tea things of George III. That's another one of those names. When you say that in the colonies, you should go hiss, psst. Yeah. The Kew Palace, where Kew Gardens is, of course, this is where it became the sanatorium for George III. When you know, we call him Crazy George III, but it was actually a blood disease that was causing all that malady, and he pretty much lived in the small palace called Kew Palace. Here you have the tea things of George III. It's good to be the king. Let's look and see. Yes, you have a beautiful royal Worcester, specially made for him, blue set. His wife was Charlotte, which Charlotte, North Carolina, is named for. And you see the tea things we have here. On the right, you see a water heater, meaning this was where water, hot water was brought from the kitchens. By the way, you can still, they just have opened up those restored kitchens. And they were underground, and they had tunnels coming out underground up to the two palaces there. The other palace is now gone. But the huge water cauldrons are down in those kitchens. And in one of the rooms, George III's bathtub was down there too. Conveniently close to the hot water. And they had 15 children, so you know you better get that hot water first before the rest of the kids did. So you have water that would be brought out, and they had a burner that would keep that water hot. Next to it is a beautiful silver teapot. And then you have the tea caddy, which is that tall porcelain piece here, and then two cups. Now, these cups now have handles on them because the English were saying, writing back to their Chinese porcelain maker, say, would you put some handles on those cups, because we're burning our little fingers over here. And so then we started getting handles. And it took a while for the English to get a hold of how to make all this porcelain. They eventually did. It was the Meissen folks in Germany who did it first, and then eventually the English got into it. And so here you have a beautiful Royal Worcester set. And by the way, they even made queensware named for Queen Charlotte. Here are the tea things of our first president, George Washington. Even as a bachelor, if you wanted to, if you were, you had any hopes of ever finding a wife, you better have a good tea set. So this is Washington's bachelor's tea set. Quite nice, don't you think? Yes, ladies, you'd have tea out of that. 1755, Chinese. You can see it at Mount Vernon today. Beautiful, beautiful set. So I spend a lot of time in Boston and in Massachusetts. Let's look at some of the tea things of Boston. Here you have a beautiful teapot made by a man who rode a horse to say the British are coming. His name was Paul Revere. Paul Revere made at least four of these beautiful silver teapots with wooden handles so you wouldn't burn your hand. This one just sold at Christie's for $235,000. He was paid £15 when he made it. To the right, you see at the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, Massachusetts, one of two beautiful tea caddies that are there. This one is made in China, very beautiful inlay and carving on it. It slips into a little wooden case, and it has a pewter name tag on it that says Suchon. Whoever made it didn't quite get the G on the end, but we know that it was Suchong tea. The one next to it that I don't have the photograph for was Haisan. So he had whoever had this tea had a green tea and a black tea. This is one of the most beautiful tea tables anywhere, and it was made in America. There are two examples of it today. This one is in the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. The other one is at the Winterthur Museum in Delaware, where I'll be giving a lecture in November. Look how gorgeous this is, with these little turnouts where you can put individual teacups. It's just glorious. Now, this is a beautiful set, and guess what? How does it look similar to what George III had? You have, over in the back corner, again, the hot water pot. You have the tea kettle, the tea pot. Then you have here silver sugar with a cover on it. Over to the far right, you see the milk pitcher, which is also called, in the time of Jane Austen, a ewer, E-W-E-R. And here you have tongs. And again, just like George III, you have a cup and saucer, and this and the cups, again, have handles on them. So, beautiful things. These are the tea things of colonial Boston. Let's get back to the notorious East India Company. By 1772, things were going bad for the East India Company because they kept putting taxes on tea and paper and anything that came over from the mother country. And the people in New England and all up and down the colonies were getting pretty tired of having to pay taxes and then not having any kind of representation back in Parliament, and eventually it all came to a head. One of the things that really brought about the Boston Tea Party was the fact that so much tea was being smuggled into the colonies, mainly through the Dutch. The Dutch would sell tea to anybody, and so Pirates were bringing it in. Smugglers were bringing it in. And pretty soon, tea was not being sold through the legal channels, so taxes were not being collected. And then you had all this tea that was coming in on all those ships from Canton into London, into their warehouses, was coming on. It was filling up the warehouses, overflowing, starting to rot, and the tea was not coming out fast enough. So the East India Company went to Parliament and said, look, if you don't do something about this, we're going to go belly up. If our company fails, all the banks will fail. If all the banks fail, the entire country will fail. We are the company too big to fail. So this was the original too big to fail company. So Parliament came up with a deal to have pretty much a garage sale, to unload 600,000 pounds of tea out of the warehouses owned by the East India Company and send it over to the colonies. 600,000 pounds. And that was just a small part of what was beginning to go to waste back in London. So, in about this time, in 1773, late August, early September, seven ships left London with the 600,000 pounds of tea on board, heading for the colonies. Aboard those ships, and here are the names of the ships, we have four ships coming to Boston, we have a ship going to Philadelphia, a ship going to all the way down to Charleston, and then a ship going to New York, because all these places were big tea-drinking places. Everybody had their tea things, and they wanted their tea. The tea that came into Boston was aboard three ships. One of the ships was wrecked off of Cape Cod. The people in Charleston, Philadelphia, and London all said to Boston, the tea's coming, we know it's coming, whatever you do, we will follow. It's up. The pressure was on Boston to make the decision. So they said, in December 16, 1773, 2,500 people in Boston, one out of every 10 people who lived there, met at Old South Meeting House to decide what to do about this tea. And they had to do something that night. They couldn't come to any conclusion, but about 140 men had already made up their mind that they were going to take matters into their own hands. And so they disguised themselves like, as they said, Mohicans. They went on board the ships with no guns, only hatchets, and they went up to the three ship captains and said, give us the keys to your holds. And they unlocked the holds, and huge chests, this is a small chest right here, these chests might have weighed as much as 350 pounds. We still have one of the chests at the museum in Boston. They broke open all those chests of tea, threw the tea overboard, into Boston Harbor. It took 2.5 hours to dispatch nearly $1 million worth of tea into the harbor. Now, the thing about it was low tide that night. And you see, all these tea leaves started coming over the rails into the harbor, and they started like haystacks alongside the ships. And so men had to go out in rowboats with rakes and rake the tea down at the harbor, where other men went around with the oars and slap the tea to try to get it to sink, because, you know, it's a leaf, it just wants to float. So it took about 2.5 hours. No shots were fired. There were no British in sight. They just stayed away from it. Everybody took an oath that they weren't going to say who they were. Nobody would talk about it once they got home, because they had just committed an act of what?
Treason.
And off with their heads. They never, to their deaths, they never said who they were. We now know who they were, including the grandfather of a man who wrote a book about a whale. Here is the invoice from that night's destruction, and it still rests in a museum in London, still unpaid. So, Jane Austen, this December 16th, 1773, was the Boston Tea Party. 2 years later, to the day, Jane Austen was born. It's just a stroke of luck. You be the decider about that. I don't know. So Jane Austen, 1775. She lived and spent a lot of time in the city of Bath. And you see that in those days, tea was the deciding factor of anyone's manners. You know, if you wanted, ladies, if a man was going to have, if you were to, even thinking you might marry this man, you better have him come to tea to see how he picked up his spoon to put it into the teacup. Did he use milk? Jane Austen wouldn't have liked it if you you were out if you put milk into your tea. That was too pedestrian for her. So, and tea was an important part of the ritual at all the assemblies in Bath. Now, thank you so much for this beautiful poster that advertised tonight's event, and it includes a beautiful picture that I took a couple years ago at the Langham Hotel in London. Let me just say, it looks absolutely nothing like what Jane Austen would have seen, which gives me opportunity just to point out a few things here. So you see here today, we have these beautiful three-tiered servers. Jane Austen never saw anything like that. That was an Edwardian invention. The scones, probably not. Nope. This champagne? No, definitely no. And little French pastries and macaroons? No, none of that. Tea was fairly common. Tea for Jane Austen would have been a pot of tea. If the parson came over to the house and unexpected, and he just showed up, you'd make him tea, and you might give him some toast or a piece of cake that was left over from the day before. The tea was the important thing. It was not all about the things that we put together with our beautiful afternoon teas today. So if you ever want to recreate a Jane Austen tea, it should be pretty simple for you, really. Let's look at a few instances of tea in the works of Jane Austen. Mansfield Park has several. Let's look at this one. The next opening of the door brought something more welcome. It was the tea things. She loved this word, the tea things. Susan and an attendant girl brought in everything necessary for the meal. So you couldn't, the little get-together, passing the cup of humanity, couldn't start until the arrival of the tea things. In the Watsons, Tom Musgrove visits the Watsons, and before going home to an 8 o'clock dinner, 8 o'clock seems pretty late, doesn't it? Yeah. Is surprised to be shown into the best parlor, where he beheld a circle of smart people arranged with all the honors of visiting around the fire, and Miss Watson seated at the best Pembroke table with the best tea things before her. Now, this Pembroke table was an invention of the day. You know what a Pembroke table? It has wings that fold down, and then they fold back up. Now, why was this important in the time of Jane Austen? Because this table, during most of the day, would be pushed up against the wall. And then when someone came over, you had to accommodate the tea things. So it was the stage for the tea things. So often these would have wheels on them. I have one in my house that has little coasters on it. It's wheeled out, the wings are raised, and all the tea things are brought out, and there they are. And your guest is just, wow, this is fantastic. Now, if you come to someone's home and the tea things are not brought out, guess what? You probably have just been snubbed in a big way, because that's just the way it is. So the other thing was that after the tea things, sometimes they would have a dance. So the tea things would be taken away, the wings go down, the tables pushed aside, and then you had space to have your dance as well. Sense and Sensibility. Eleanor attends a social gathering at Lady Middleton's, eager to have a chat with Lucy. But the insipidity of the meeting was exactly such as Eleanor had expected. It produced not one novelty of thought or expression, and nothing could be less interesting than the whole of their discourse, both in the dining parlor and drawing room. They quitted it only with the removal of the tea things. So when the tea things are taken away, that's your cue that it's over. You've had your chance, and you're on your way. So that was like the hook in the theater. You're off. Well, what were those tea things that went on those Pembroke tables? Let's look. Well, one of the very first things was a tea caddy. This is what you kept your tea in. And these are, I have quite a collection of tea caddies. This is my favorite. It's a Regency tea caddy. Beautiful compartments, mixing bowl in the middle, maybe for sugar, and a smaller one to the side. What do you notice on the front of both of these caddies? A key. So the lady of the house would keep the key because she didn't want the servants, you know, snitching any of this very, 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 let me emphasize, very expensive tea. So it was kept not in the kitchen. It was kept in the most visible room of the house. So if you had a parlor, the tea caddy was always in that parlor. If you were very rich, you had a tea poi, meaning this is where your tea caddy sat while it waited for the tea thing, the arrival of the tea things. Again, when someone entered your house and they saw the tea caddy, it was a status symbol. So the very first tea caddies were porcelain from China, and then the English started making them, especially up until the 1850s when tea started getting less expensive. There wasn't a need for it. One of my favorite tea things is a moat spoon. Someplace I have a moat spoon, but this is moat. It's the old English word for moat, not the M-O-A-T that goes around a castle. This is for you biblical scholars from Matthew. And why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye? But considerest not the beam that is in thine own eye. It's a little joke here, saying that you know you have a speck in your eye, but you pay no attention to that. The speck, you talk about the speck that's in your brother's eye, but you have a beam in your own eye. So it's an exaggerated joke. Mote is something that's there that should not be there. Well, what could be a mote in the tea world? We find it in Mansfield Park because we see she sat in a blaze of oppressive heat, in a cloud of moving dust, and her eyes could only wander from the walls to the tea board, never thoroughly cleaned, the cups and saucers wiped in streaks, the milk a mixture of motes floating in thin blue. Have you ever, those of you who are coffee drinkers, have you ever gone on vacation, come back and I'll make a cup of coffee and you've forgotten, well, you haven't bought milk yet. And so you put your milk into the cup and you pour the coffee on top of it. You know what happens? You have little motes of cream on top that are not very appetizing. So you need to demote your tea. You see, this is a time when there were no refrigerators, so the milk often went bad pretty quickly. Or, you know, when you pour, the English have this habit of just putting their tea loose into the pot, you know, and they pour it. Sometimes an errant leaf will come out into your cup. Well, you can't have that. There's a mote in my tea. So you have to demote your tea. So you reach over with this long-handled spoon that has slots in the bowl, and you remove that with the strainer. Now, why does it have a long, pointy end on it? Because, again, the English sometimes would pour tea, and the spout would clog. So this was a Roto-Rooter. You could put it in, and you could clean the spout. When Jane Austen was at Bath and she did go to tea, we do know that she did go to the assembly rooms, to the pump room that is there now, because it was redone and by the time she was there. So this is a photograph I shot in the pump room a few years ago. So this would be an example of tea at Bath. Of course, today they bring out those three-tiered servers and everything. It's not Austen-esque, but it's what everybody wants to enjoy. And here you have, again, a tea urn, because you would often have at dance in the evenings at the assembly rooms, you would have an intermission. And you would move from one room into the ante room where the tea things would be. And so it would be tea during the intermission. And so you would make up lots of tea in a beautiful urn like this. Thomas Jefferson at Monticello had urns like this. George Washington had urns like this. So everybody who was into tea had their tea urn. This is one of my favorite and very sad little snippets from Northanger Abbey. Catherine Morland attends her first assembly at the Upper Rooms in Bath, but she has no dancing partner to escort her to tea. At intermission, she and Ms. Allen find themselves tea-less. Now, you understand at the time, if you are a woman at one of these dances, you better have a man with you when you move into the anteroom for tea, because a woman could just not get up from her table and go to that beautiful urn and draw a cup of tea. It was just very bad etiquette, and nobody was going to break that protocol. So the two of them find themselves there with no man, and it's the break time. Then they move into the tea room, and they don't know anybody there. There's no table where they can go and just join them. So they just kind of sit themselves at the end of a table. They don't know these people either. You know, we've all been there. It's sad. It's just you feel like, I just want to crawl at the table. And look what she says. Everybody was shortly in motion for tea, and they must squeeze out like the rest. When at last arrived in the tea room, she felt yet more awkwardness of having no party to join, no acquaintances to claim, no gentlemen to assist them. They were obliged to sit down at the end of a table at which a large party were already placed, without having anything to do there or anybody to speak to except each other. Can't you just feel? I feel sad for these two ladies, you know? And so she says, had we better go away as it is? Catherine asked. Here are no tea things for us, you see. Our lives are ruined without our tea things. And no man, by the way. And eventually, a gentleman at the table takes pity on them and brings them tea. The night is saved. What? You know, every time I read that, I see that there. And I feel the angst and the anguish from those women sitting at that table waiting for their tea things. Where did Jane Austen buy her tea? Well, we find this little letter to Cassandra, her sister, from 1814, says, I am sorry to hear that there has been a rise in tea. I do not mean to pay Twining till later in the day when we may order a fresh supply. So she went all the way from Charlton into London to buy her tea, because she knew the Twining's company sold good tea. There was a whole industry of recycling spent tea leaves that were adulterated with all kinds of things to put color back in them. And so she knew she could trust the Twinings to always have good tea. So that's where she got hers. Here is the Twinings tea shop, opened in 1706, again, as Tom's Coffee. And then they started tea. It's still there on the Strand. These are the Twining, two of the Twinings that work here. I was just there a couple years ago, spent the morning with Stephen Twining, the 10th generation of the Twinings company. We got out the tea things, and we had tea all morning there. So if you go to London, it's on the Strand, just down from the Savoy. Stop in, have a cup of tea, and tell Stephen that Bruce sent you back. Or better yet, say, Jane Austen sent me here. Yeah. Well, how about Kentucky? We actually have tea things of Kentucky. Did you know that? Asa Blanchard was the great silver maker. He was the Paul Revere of Kentucky when it came to silver making. And he set up shop in downtown Lexington in the early 1800s, and he was advertising in 1806 that he was making tea things. So Kentucky had some beautiful tea things. That's his portrait by Matthew Jewett. And both of these pieces are in the new Kentucky Room in Louisville at the Speed Museum. If you haven't been there, go see it. Here we have two beautiful sugar chests that were made in my neck of the woods. One, a Bourbon County sugar chest, and then a Lincoln County sugar chest. So tea was important, was expensive. Sugar in the frontier was equally hard to get. And so again, it was kept under lock and key. Well, by the 1800s, we here in Kentucky were getting our tea not from China, but our tea was coming in from San Francisco, coming across on transcontinental railroads. But the tea was being sourced in Japan, number one. By 1890, 40% of the tea consumed in the United States was green and oolong tea from Japan, and then also eventually from Taiwan. So here you have a general store tea container from the turn of the century, and it has on it Formosa, and we know that Formosa is now what? Taiwan.
Right.
So you could have, this was from a Kentucky general store. So Kentucky does have a history of tea, including my house in Perryville, Kentucky, built in 1842, where we got our start in the world of tea by having an English-style afternoon tea from 1990 until 2004. And this was groundbreaking because America was not, at this time, the current tea renaissance had not started until about that time. We just happened to be right at the cusp of that revolution. And so from this historic home, which is now our personal home, no longer open to the public, so don't come and knock on my door and say you'd like to have a cup of tea. No matter how pitiful you look, you're not going to get it. I'm not going to get no tea things for you, sorry. But this has a great history of tea as well. This is an article I just wrote that's coming out in the November-December issue of Tea Time magazine on this lecture, Tea Things of Jane Austen. I brought advanced copies of that if you want to take home one with you tonight. Just about everything that I've told you tonight, all those stories, come from my latest book, which is A Social History of Tea. This is how tea has influenced Western culture for 400 years. No small matter. And it's all these stories that you heard tonight are in there. If you're interested in Japanese tea, my book on the Book of Tea is the book for you. Also, tonight we have copies of The Great Tea Rooms of America, The Great Tea Rooms of Britain. These are photo books of, if you want to just dream of all these wonderful places to have tea, they're in there. And then if you're really a good student, this is the most used reference book to tea in the world. When you go into Twining's shop in London, they'll pull this out if you have a question about tea, and it's produced in Danville, Kentucky. This is the third edition of the New Tea Companion that I write with Jane Pettigrew in London. So those are just a few of the things I brought with me tonight, but I always like to take time for a couple of questions, so if you have a couple of questions before we do our giveaway, let's have them. Yes, you have a question right here.
Yeah. The phrase dish of tea.
Dish of tea.
Yeah. Was it ever poured into one of those saucers?
Well, only in bad manners. There was a time in the Victorian age when people would often ask you, come on for a dish of tea, mm-hmm. because the tea bowls were actually much larger at one time. Mm-hmm. And then the saucers were larger. There was an unfortunate time during the Victorian age where occasionally people would pour their hot tea into their bowl and drink. When that happened, where do you put your teacup? You can't put it on a wooden table because you're holding the saucer. So what do? So the English invented a cup plate. This just fits your cup. And so the pressed glass industry here in the United States, especially in Sandwich, Massachusetts, started making pressed glass cup plates by the thousands in the 1800s. And often politicians would use these with their face and their name emblazoned on them to give away as little favors to win your vote. This is from, in my collection, this is one of my favorites from a Kentucky politician of the early 1800s who lived in Lexington in a house named Ashland. His name was Henry Clay, and Henry Clay's face is right on that. He gave this away to somebody in the 1800s. Good question. Yeah. Not another?
Questions? You know, I was on a cruise ship recently, and I was sitting next to a lot of Texans, and we're having high tea in the afternoon, and I noticed one of the gentlemen there are pouring the tea into the saucer.
Yeah.
And said, you know, this is how you drink high tea, and I'm looking at them and thinking, who are these people?
Well, let me say that grammatically he was correct, because you see, we have, as Americans, misuse the word high tea. High tea is not fancy. High tea is not elegant. high tea in the Victorian age was a common supper taken at a high dining table of meat, bread, cheese, all these things, accompanied by a pot of tea. It was the evening meal. Afternoon tea, or low tea, was taken in the hotel lobbies and libraries and in London, where you would be seated in a cushy sofa or big chair, and the table had to be much lower, you see, and it would be brought up to you, and that was called low tea. But at home, it was called high tea. It was taken at a high table. Low teas were always more elegant. But, of course, if you say, I can charge you $20 for tea, but if I charge you, I can charge you $30 for high tea, the hotels today are going to charge you the $30 and call it high tea. Right. Now, but that they would not have poured it, you wouldn't never want to pour it into your cup. The other thing is that if you did, when you pour the tea, you always had a strainer like this. This is Edwardian days. If in the Downton Abbey home, the people upstairs had this, people downstairs had this, a little strainer that had its own little swivel cup that would catch any of the dribble like that. So this was downstairs. This was upstairs. You understand? Okay.
Questions?
Yes.
So you mentioned that also that at the Edwardian period was when the three-tiered platter came. Is that also when the idea of having all the meats, as you said, et cetera, came in?
Well, it was then during the Industrial Age, especially in Glasgow, which was one of the big industrial cities. And people worked really hard, I mean, long hours. They get home at night, and they were just famished. And that's when they actually started having those kind of things as well. I got one little question. This little tea chest, if you lived in London, you would take this into a store, and you'd bring it home, and it would hold 7 pounds of tea, and it came from F&M. What is that? Fortnum and Mason. We do have some Anglophiles in here tonight.
Time for one more question?
Yes?
Today, tea is very popular for its medicinal qualities. Is that something that was advertised in the era of Jane Austen, or is that a rather new
development? Absolutely not. Actually, tea started out as medicine and then became a beverage. So originally, it was something you drank for medicinal purposes, and then eventually became a beverage. I write a lot on the health benefits of tea. I will leave you with this one thought, that one of the healthiest things that you can drink is green tea, but always make green tea not with boiling water. It needs to be off boil, but it's very healthy for you. A lot of antioxidants in it. If you want to even boost it even more, add a little bit of either lemon juice, orange juice, citric acid to your tea to keep it alive in your gut a little bit longer. Now, that's your...
What's the best-selling tea from Helmwood Inn?
We launched 2 years ago our new bourbon tea. So, yes, we say it has all the flavor and none of the guilt. So if you want to buy something to give to your friends out of state who are teetotalers, this is the tea. You can find this at every Kroger store in the Kentucky Proud Department. So tonight we're going to give away a bourbon tea. We're also going to give away from the Boston Tea Party Ships Museum. This is Abigail's Blend, named after Abigail Adams. And we built a 100-seat tea room on the top of that museum named Abigail's Tea Room. And Abigail Adams' picture hangs proudly over the mantle. But this is Abigail's Blend that I blended especially for that museum. So we're going to give away two of these tonight. Are we ready to do it?
We're ready. And on that note, I want to especially thank our speaker.
Let me just say that, I'm a seminary graduate, so I always have to leave you with a benediction. And so that is, go forth and make good tea.